Increased spending and no new taxes. Just ahead, a look at Mayor Lenny Curry's proposed budget for the city of Jacksonville. Good Tuesday morning and live from Studio 5. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9. Thanks for listening. I'm Melissa Ross. Hope your day's off to a good start. Never miss a show. Our podcast is now on iTunes and Stitcher. And just ahead, we'll take your calls on Mayor Curry's plans for the city. Let us know what you think at 549-2937. Then later, our book club looks at the enduring appeal of the great Harper Lee, plus important health research on asthma at Edward Waters College. We'll tell you about it. All of that ahead, but first this morning on Monday, Jacksonville Mayor Lenny Curry presented his $1.14 billion spending plan to the City Council. Curry wants more police officers and firefighters on the streets, plus additional money for roads, bridges, sidewalks, even libraries. But as one council member said, as they begin to go through the budget, the devil is always in the details. So right now, we're starting off the hour with a closer look at Mayor Curry's budget proposal and taking your calls as we welcome our own regular contributor, A.G. Gankarski of Florida Politics. Always good to see you. Good morning.
Good to see you and good morning, too.
And here's our question to callers. What are your thoughts and comments about Mayor Lenny Curry's budget proposal and his plans for the city for the next 4 years? Give us a call, 549-2937. That's 549-2937. Or go online to wjctnews.org/firstcoastconnect and email and tweet the show. Okay, so Mayor Curry presenting his budget to the council Monday, saying it's financially sound and that he wants to invest in street resurfacing, sidewalk repairs, parks, library renovations, and public safety. Let's talk about this one by one. Let's begin with looking at Curry's emphasis on infrastructure. What's your thought about that?
Well, there's been a real infrastructure backlog over the last few years. You've got sidewalk repairs that are up to 3 years out, according to Councilman Reggie Brown. You got issues with brownfields. You got issues with remediation for ash sites and things like that. Roadways, obviously. Liberty Street. All of these are of a piece. What's happened in recent years is that these projects have been pushed back, under a fiscal rectitude platform. The problem with that is that you defer to repair costs, sometimes it mitigates replacement. And what the Curry team did in June was they did their budget review sessions with departments. They found money in subfunds and so forth. And basically, that's what's paying for the first round of the capital improvements, among other things. There is some borrowing for other things in the budget, but not for these infrastructure projects. They're pretty much self-sustaining from budgetary savings.
He also wants the JSO to hire 40 more police officers and bring back 40 community service officers. They are the employees that tend to handle traffic accidents, and those positions had been cut during the recession. The big push on public safety, AG, of course, Mayor Curry campaigned on that, and his new budget seems to reflect that as a priority as well.
Right. And I do want to address the community service officers. It's something that we missed in the last couple of years in Jacksonville. The CSOs basically would do tasks that normal officers wouldn't do, traffic accidents and basically assistance, the cat in a tree kind of things. And these are things that kind of give the police officers soft power. I mean, they're force enhancers for the police officers. They're doing more dangerous details, everything from speed traps to, raids to basically, high-speed chases, whatever else. I mean, this is more dangerous stuff. The CSOs are basically supplementary. And Curry did talk about how he wanted to restore 147 police officers and 92 CSOs during the campaign. This is a first step toward that. You can't do it all at once because JSO has classes that go through and there's only so many that can be processed at one time. The budget doesn't allow for an en masse influx of officers. The culture doesn't really either. So this is a way to do it incrementally, slow and steady.
We'll go to your calls as we discuss Mayor Curry's proposed spending plan for Jacksonville. His budget still has to be approved by the City Council. What are your questions and thoughts? 549-2937. Now, Mayor Curry saying his proposed budget will not increase the property tax rate. He's also saying he won't tap financial reserves to turn in a balanced budget. How is that going to be accomplished?
Well, the savings that we talked about are a big deal. The question that some people have is, well, is that sustainable? I mean, there's obviously some energy predicated on that drill down audit that used to be called the 90-day audit. It's not going to take exactly 90 days, so it's been reframed as a drill down audit, but they're expecting to find more in there, more efficiencies. And really, I think that's the plan. If they run government leaner and meaner, like you said during the campaign, a $1 billion budget can go farther than it otherwise might have. And that's the bet they're making. But that said, yesterday during the press gaggle, he said once they get into the audit part and, you know, find out what they have, all options are on the table. He did not rule out a tax increase the way he did during the campaign. And, you know, people like John Delaney and the adults in the room in Jacksonville's posted ideologues are saying, yes, we might need to look at sales tax. Yes, we might need to look at millage rate. So these options will be discussed. I mean, they're not going to be something that, you know, he's going to score political points with. Nobody says, yes, I want my taxes raised. But we do want responsible spending. We do want infrastructure that is from the 21st century. And, you know, we can tell by the roads, the sidewalks, everything like that. I mean, go back to the sidewalks. You got liability issues that emerge in these things. A broken sidewalk, somebody's running or walking or what have you, breaks a hip. Who's on the hook for that? Quite likely the city if these people have a decent lawyer. And this is really the issue. It's like if you don't fix it, you're going to pay for it down the road.
And let's go to your calls right now. What are your thoughts and comments about Mayor Curry's budget plan for the city? We'll go to your tweets in a moment. 549-2937, the number to join us. Susan on the west side. Hi, Susan. Good morning.
Good morning. I have a concern about using the budget to hire more resource officers. The resource officers that I have dealt with have just been very angry. They have like an authority complex, and they really don't have the power, and I could see that money being better used by actually hiring police officers. And just for a suggestion, if you want to have resource officers, we need to build up a better community relation, community family. And maybe putting them back on foot patrol as officers used to be, where people in their neighborhoods knew their police officers, and they could be used in that way. But that seems to be the route that cities are going now, using resource officers. But put them on the ground, on the beat, so that they can then build community relations with the community. That's all I have to say.
And that's Susan. Okay. Yeah. And that's Susan on the west side. Okay. Let's discuss her feedback on that. Community service officers versus uniformed officers that can respond to major crimes.
Right. And, you know, they're really two different tasks. I mean, in chess, you've got different players on the board, pawns, bishops, what have you. And it's that way in police work as well. You do not need the SWAT team to come out to respond to a traffic accident. Ideally, you don't want that to happen. Going back to what she said, the CSOs are actually cheaper in terms of, equipment needed, salaries, all that, the normal cops. And that's the issue. Regarding the foot patrol point, Ken Jefferson made that throughout the campaign, and it was something that, you know, he believed there should be more community policing. Remains to be seen if that will happen, because cops right now, they're still going from, you know, point A to point B without much time to reflect or build relationships. Is something that happens especially in the neighborhoods with the worst crime issues. 103rd Street's one. So if you look at it that way, how do citizens get to know their police officers? I mean, you can actually go to things like Shadco and stuff like that. Talk to officers there. And that's probably the best way it is for the moment, but I'm sure as they get their forces to where they need to be, they will do more in the way of foot patrols and things like that, because community policing is obviously the way to go for crime prevention.
And if you're just tuning in, we'll go back to your calls in just a moment at 549-2937 as we discuss Mayor Curry's budget for the city. The city council still has to approve it. Lots of tweets. Here's one from the St. John's River Ferry. Thank you to Lenny Curry for adding funds to pay for mandatory ferry repairs. Curry wants $900,000 to be allotted to keep the St. John's River Ferry, much beloved in this area, going. That's a service that's been threatened off and on for some time. Curry saying, let's keep the ferry afloat. Also, he's saying level funding for the also threatened UF Health Jacksonville, which has been on the bubble as well.
Yeah, I mean, these are two important points, and you know they resonate with the community. The ferry was something that when Ricks got vetoed, there was a lot of consternation locally. Lenny Curry, he does really well at the beaches in terms of polling, in terms of how he got through the election. Obviously, the beaches delivered the election to him. So for him to, threaten the Mayport Ferry would be political suicide. And regarding UF Health, that's an interesting story too, because, yeah, it is a flat budget for UF Health. But, you know, the real takeaway was not that budget, they're defined for the year. However, it's getting stakeholders together, the chamber, civic council, obviously UF Health and, you know, the other hospitals, and finding ways to improve the commercial payers going through UF Health, because that's really where they get their profit from. And, you know, that's what's going to happen over the next year or two, is finding ways to get more of a payer mix where it's not just, you know, people who are government subsidized going, but it's actually people who have private insurance, because that's where the profit for UF Health comes from.
Meanwhile, we're getting emails and tweets about the $58 million that has been found in the budget. Scott emails the show, why is it that when $58 million are found, that money doesn't go toward paying down the pension debt?
Well, because we have these infrastructure issues that have been waiting for years and for decades. I mean, you got fire stations in District 9 and District 10 from 1960. They are not ADA compliant, and there's a lot of ADA compliance issues in this budget. We'll get to those also. But, you know, they're moldy. They've got issues with roof leakage and everything else. They're not equipped for today's equipment. So you have to take care of those issues. You know, I've looked at the CIP plan, the capital improvement plan, and by and large, the investments are not, let's build the Taj Mahal courthouse, or, you know, let's build Shad Khan a theme park. It's more like, let's build a fire station. Let's fix the sidewalk. Let's fix the decaying pier at the beach. I mean, these are issues that have to be dealt with, and the pension debt is a different matter. It's something that obviously is on the table, but, you know, we are working toward a pension resolution and, you know, working toward paying that, and the Curry team does have a plan that they're working out right now. They're not talking about it to much of anybody, but it's something that could be very significant in savings if it actually pans out the way they say it's going to.
Brian tweets the show, do those remediation funds include the shipyards?
Yes, $17.5 million is going toward remediation, and that's a big step. If you want Shad Khan's plan to actually work there, if you want to see downtown actually revive, you've got to have that shipyards working, and you can't have contaminated soil. I mean, it's prime real estate, and it's something that, you know, we benefited as a city from the shipyards for decades. Now we have to clean up our mess. So $17.5 million is the first installment, and we'll see where it goes from there.
Here's an email from David. If the city is always crying poor about revenue, why have we been subsidizing development for decades? The most easily remedied of all of these would be impact fees. Large developments like Tamaya on the south side strain infrastructure and services even further. Mayor Curry, quit the corporate welfare today.
Well, that's a historic argument. I mean, Jacksonville's been built on development and stretching out and expanding development. I mean, it's really been the last couple of decades where people have looked at the urban core in a different way as well. We need to get the urban core right. And that lines up with development programs throughout the Sun Belt, throughout much of the rest of the country, new land, build out, and worry about the infrastructure later. And
there is a tension between that impetus and this new focus on let's bring everybody back to the urban core, let's put our money and our energy in the city center, let's build up downtown. That tension exists.
Yeah, I mean, you got to have choices. I mean, I'm the type of person, I don't leave the urban core unless I have to. I don't go to Orange Park or Mandarin unless I'm there for an assignment. And that's my cognitive bias. That said, you've got to have options. Not everybody wants to live in an urban environment. Some people want the suburban, 3,000 square foot property, and you've got to provide that for them. And, you know, luckily we have the land to do so in Jacksonville, but it's always a struggle, you know, developers' interest, such as they are versus those of the larger community. And it's something that Lenny Curry, like every other mayor in Jacksonville history, is going to deal with.
And lots of calls. What are your questions and thoughts about Mayor Curry's budget proposal for the city? It's over $1 billion, 549-2937. Warren in Arlington. Hi, Warren. Good morning.
Hey, good morning. I was on the Jacksonville Journey when it first started, and I was on the subtask force that was with Audrey Moran, Linda Lanier, Chris Hazlett, Wyman Wimbush. And we were charged with looking at what would be the solutions of working with our children. And our overwhelming solution was stronger mentoring programs, specifically one-to-one mentoring programs in Jacksonville. That was completely blown out of the water. There was zero funding that came from the Journey at that particular time. And that was the only task force that didn't get funded, which came as a great surprise to Audrey, myself, and Linda. And I wondered where that fits in child prevention and intervention in the current budget, because I understand that there's more money for the Journey in this particular budget. I'll take my answer offline. Thank you very much.
Yeah. Thanks, Warren. Thanks for the call.
That's a great call, and he raised great concern. The Jacksonville Journey budget is up to $5 million, roughly, from about $2 million, roughly, in the current budget. Basically, the $3 million is unitemized from what I saw. You know, they've got programs in there and are basically being held flat, some a little more, some a little less. But the $3 million is so they can actually repurpose the Journey and move things under that umbrella. I know that Lenny Curry himself is very devoted to mentoring. He talked about during his inauguration. He's reached out to John Guns. He has meetings with the pastors, Guns and the New Bill and, you know, John Newman every week, it seems. He had one the other day. So, you know, in terms of getting the mentoring piece right, I think Curry's strategy, and he's told me this, is to reach out to the people who are actually in the communities, allow them to help him build the relationships, and, you know, to build a framework. And this goes back to what Republican mayors have dealt with over the last quarter century. John Delaney told me that when he ran the first time, he didn't get much black support at all. So what he does, he's in the black churches every Sunday for a year. And, you know, he went, his reaction went from cold to cool to warm. And, you know, John Delaney is arguably the most beloved mayor in Jacksonville history, in part because he did that work. And, you know, Lenny Curry takes notes, he's careful, and he also believes in this stuff. I mean, he's been to Grand Park and, you know, Eureka Gardens and places like that. And, you know, it's outside of his comfort zone, but he goes because, you know, he understands that for Jacksonville to turn around, there's got to be hope given to the young people who are in the, you know, most crime-ridden communities.
Let's take a few more calls. 549-2937, Marie in Jacksonville. Hi, Marie. Good morning.
Hi. I just wanted to know if it's possible to develop solar energy. I mean, we are the Sunshine State, but we have the strictest laws in the country against developing solar energy. Is there any hope under this administration for that?
Yeah. Thanks, Marie. You know, that's really more of a comment about the state legislature than City Hall. But let's talk about that, because there is a statewide effort going on, bipartisan, to put an amendment on Florida's ballot in 2016 that would free up the buying and selling of solar power around the state. Florida's laws do lag other surrounding states, particularly Georgia, mm-hmm. which is far ahead of us in terms of how they're developing that market. What are your thoughts about that?
Well, I think if you're looking at energy sources, I mean, we're looking at things like offshore drilling and everything like that. I don't see how solar energy can't be on the table unless you're trying to protect monopolies. And that's what utility company ultimately is. It's a government-protected monopoly. So, you know, having that discussion, whether it's on a referendum basis or whether it's on the state level or whether it's on the local level, I think is productive, because we're always looking for new energy solutions. And, you know, solar energy, if it's one of them, it's one that needs to be explored, because, you know, fossil fuels are finite. They might do fracking and find things. They might drill in the Atlantic Ocean and find things. But, you know, you're still dealing with things that are mm-hmm. finite. The sun is not finite.
Yeah, that's more of a state government question, though. It'll be interesting to see how that the fate of that proposed ballot amendment.
I'm not expecting the Curry administration to lead on it.
Yeah. What are your final thoughts?
My final thoughts is, you know, you've got a budget here that has something for every district, perhaps on purpose. You know, Curry It seems to be financially sound. And this is the thing that media has noticed. The presentation of the budget was much more linear and much more clear than it was during the previous administration. You know, you get the book, you get the draft 5 days out so you can actually digest it. You're getting to answer questions. It's not like you show up to the budget hearing and then you find out, oh, these are the priorities. I mean, it's kind of like getting a Russian novel and actually getting a few days to read it before you talk about it versus, okay, well, you know, here's War and Peace in the original Russian. Good luck with it. I think what they're doing with their process is framing the narrative in a way that's digestible and understandable, and it's helping them get ahead of questions that, you know, council people, media, and concerned citizens might have had.
Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Much more still ahead later. Research on the Edward Waters College campus could help reduce rates of asthma in the city. But up next, our book club revisits a classic, Harper Lee's To Kill a Mockingbird. Back in a moment.
Legal and political segments on First Coast Connect, brought to you by Farrah and Farrah. WJCT and Community First Credit Union are proud to announce that Mary Enworth will be this year's morning keynote speaker at Teach. Mary is co-author of Pathways to the Common Core. She is deputy director of middle schools at the Teachers Reading and Writing Project, Columbia University. Mary is just one of the many great speakers you will hear throughout the day. For more information or to purchase tickets, go to WJCT/teach.
I got some good news to tell you.
What?
About me and Chester.
Girl. Woo! I know what it is! Oh, you're girl. Breaking up with him.
The new film Tangerine is about two trans women who are sex workers in L.A. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with the director, Sean Baker, and with one of the film's stars, Maya Taylor. Join us. Weekdays at noon on 89.9 WJCT, community-supported public radio.
WJCT invites you to see some of your favorite radio shows and podcasts performed on stage and beamed to your local movie screen. Cast Party, featuring Radiolab, Invisibilia, Reply All, The Truth, and comedian Lauren Lapkus, all performing stories on stage, plus music, dance, original comedy videos, very special guests, and more. Cast Party, one night, Tuesday, July 28th. More info at WJCT.org or castparty.org.
WJCT, the Cultural Council of Greater Jacksonville, and Grassroots Natural Market are accepting submissions from local artists for The Square. The Square is an online venue where local artists share their work with the community and compete for a chance to be featured on WJCT-TV and radio. Submit now through July 31st. To learn more about The Square and to submit your work, visit wjct.org/thesquare.
Welcome back. And it's news that has rocked the publishing world. Go Set a Watchman, Harper Lee's much-anticipated follow-up to the 1960 classic To Kill a Mockingbird, sold more than 1.1 million copies in its first week in the U.S. and Canada. Publisher HarperCollins said Monday, that makes Watchmen the fastest-selling book in their history. It's a sequel of sorts to Lee's Pulitzer Prize-winning story, continuing the tale of Scout Finch and her lawyer father, Atticus, during the Civil Rights South. But even though Go Set a Watchman is all the rage this week, right now our book club is going to focus on the original, To Kill a Mockingbird. And we're also going to take your calls on that flap over challenged books in the Duval County Public Schools. Our book club leader, Stacy Goldring, here in studio. Good to see you.
Good morning.
We'll go to your calls in just a moment at 549-2937. Right now, we want you to tell us, what is it about To Kill a Mockingbird that's been special to you over the years? And before we get into Mockingbird, let me ask you your reaction to this incredible sales figure for Harper Lee's Go Set a Watchman.
Well, good for her. This is a woman that I believe it was 1968, when a school board voted to reject her book and wanted it banned from the shelves, she sent $10 to the editor of the local newspaper saying, please let everyone on the school board use that money to attend the first grade of their choice.
Wow.
Yeah, she's got moxie.
That's a good story.
Yeah, yeah. I think it's fabulous. I listened to absolutely zero amount of information on Watchmen before it came out. I'm not interested in what the New York Times has to say, nor CNN or HuffPost. When I read a book, I want to go in as a...
And judge it yourself.
Yeah, I want to be a book virgin. So okay. I went... Every time I heard about Watchmen, and I read the book. I read the book. I read it in one day. Nothing got done at the Wuthering household. I read the book, and here's what I have to say about it. If you love To Kill a Mockingbird, you owe it to yourself to read this book. End of story. Because it kicked me in the rear end.
Why?
Fabulous. Fabulous. You know, when near the end of Atlas Shrugged, when Ayn Rand goes on this diatribe with John Galt and objectivism, and it goes on forever and you fall asleep. But it, and Upton Sinclair with The Jungle, and he goes on, you know, on and on and on about blah, 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 near the end. Well, being that she was, this was her first draft, evidently, first manuscript, she also has the raw courage to talk about exactly how she feels. And I believe that this book could not have been published in 1960.
Yeah, probably not.
No.
It's what's
beautifully done.
What's fascinating is that in her first attack at this, Atticus Finch is a bigot. But then when she came out with To Kill a Mockingbird, he's mm-hmm. this saintly figure a few mm-hmm. years later.
Well, you know, reality. Reality. It's reality, and it's, you know, he is a he is depicted in the first book, I believe, in a more realistic of the times. Really, the book is an homage to her father, both books. It's an homage, really, to American society, warts and all. It's beyond Atticus. It's above her father, Amma, A-M-A, that was his name. But it is what Mockingbird is and what Watchmen is showing America what we are. And we really don't want to talk about that. But it's actually more than that, Melissa. This book, Mockingbird, which I'll move on to now, is really an ode to the love of reading. You can read Mockingbird, and you can see throughout the book, there are references to several books. Because Harper Lee, I believe, is trying to say, I won't speak for her, what I gleaned from her book is that reading, the freedom to read, equals freedom to live. So we see Atticus reading the newspaper when that band of crazy men from out of town want to come and they want to lynch Tom. We see Atticus reading at night to his children. We see Zebo in church lining so the members of the congregation of First Purchase Church, Calpurnia's church, can sing along because he knows how to read. That is his ticket to freedom. How does Calpurnia learn how to read? From Atticus's Blackstone Commentaries. What is that? That is a legal manuscript from the 1800s that our American Constitution and laws is based out of. So every step you turn, reading is the answer. Reading is where you run to. You could read To Kill a Mockingbird and never, ever read a word of Harper Lee, but you can read her references to what people are reading, and you have read To Kill a Mockingbird. Because what does a mockingbird do? A mockingbird sings a song, right? It's a songbird. To kill a mockingbird, to kill that song, if you kill the ability to read, you eliminate freedom. And that's what she's saying. That's what I interpret.
That's your take.
Yes,
yeah.
When I walked away
and
from this book.
And that is a beautiful interpretation. We'll go to your calls. It's our book club right now. We're talking about To Kill a Mockingbird, and we want your calls at 549-2937. We also want your calls because, Stacy, you're leading the banned conversations in the city about banned books. And there's been a flap this week about two books that are part of the curriculum in the Duval mm-hmm. County Public Schools mm-hmm. for elementary school readers, both the little chapter books set in the Middle East.
And Nasreen's Secret School and The Librarian of Basra. You know, I had a wonderful banned book discussion at the beautiful main library last week in their lounge, and you're allowed to eat in the library. I still have a hard time with that, that you can eat in the library. That's, to me, that's like, oh, you don't do that. Sacrilegious. But anyway, so... we had a wonderful discussion about Mockingbird. There were a lot of educators there, and I thought that just shows their dedication to the love of teaching books, banned or otherwise. I think it's very interesting. But I'll go back to what I gleaned from Harper Lee, and that is if you eliminate the opportunity to read and be exposed to others, you eliminate the opportunity to connect with others.
So you disagree with the...
Yes.
The impetus, yes. The petition to not include those books.
Correct. Yeah, if you're not including those books, you are caving into fear of the unknown. We fear the unknown, thus we all run back to our little tribe. Oh, can't do that. It's going to upset someone. You know, it's going to upset my child, blah, blah, blah. But if it is taught in the culture of the classroom with the teacher and it is led, you know, and given by a librarian, it's in the proper context.
What was ironic to note was that Superintendent Vitti pointed out both of these books that are being petitioned to be removed are books that tell a story of a love of learning and reading. Pretty ironic.
Yeah, very. Well, you know, there you go.
Okay, let's go to your calls at 549-2937. Paul in Jacksonville. Hi, Paul.
Hi.
Good morning, Paul.
Good morning. Am I on?
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay. To Kill a Mockingbird is widely believed in the literary elite to have been written by Truman Capote. It reflects his early writing style. Second of all, Truman Capote had already achieved fame and fortune by Breakfast and Tiffany's in the late 50s. Mm-hmm. And at the present time that To Kill a Mockingbird was published, he was working on In Cold Blood. And the last thing
Excellent
he wanted
book.
Prisoners to know was that he was reflecting a female narrative.
Okay, Paul, let me tell you something. I am so excited that you called and brought this up, because I would rather have someone call, such as you, Paul, this morning, and discuss the problems regarding, you know, the back and forth that's been going on for years regarding Truman and Nell or Harper Lee. I'd rather talk about that brouhaha than the size of somebody's income, their cars, their reality show. I think it's wonderful that you called to discuss this. This is something that won't go away, and that's fine, because it makes literature kind of fun to think that maybe someone wrote something or, you know, stole something, whatever. I'm not going to even go there. I'm a firm believer that Harper Lee wrote this book, end of story. And I can even give you a very fun quote from To Kill a Mockingbird. Quote, I did not understand how he could sit there in cold blood and read a newspaper when his only son stood an excellent chance of being murdered with the Confederate Army relic. So there you have the little title, In Cold Blood, written in To Kill a Mockingbird while Scout is reflecting on Jem being in peril, because if you remember, Miss Henry Lafayette, I think it's Dubose, is threatening the children every time they walk by her house, and they end up actually reading Ivanhoe to her because she's trying to kick her opium habit, and by having the children read to her, and she keeps them longer and longer in the house each time they have to come read to her, that she kicks the habit, and she's able to die a woman who was able to die with some self-respect. So again, using literature as a way to free oneself to read, to learn, and to die with dignity. Thank you, Paul.
Hey, Paul, thanks for the call. You know, I hadn't heard that rumor, but
it's been around
a long time.
Yeah, yeah.
Apparently, NPR reported in 2006 that longstanding rumor was debunked by a letter that was uncovered. They interviewed a professor at Auburn University, and they found a letter from Capote to his aunt dated July 9th, 1959, mm-hmm. that's been made public. And the letter, basically, he tells his aunt he'd seen her draft of the novel and liked it. Mm-hmm. I haven't seen this letter, but that apparently it debunks the rumor that Capote wrote Mockingbird. And the rumor apparently got started when a lady named Pearl Bell, a literary critic and editor in Cambridge, Mass., implied to friends that Capote had something to do with the writing of the book.
Well, it keeps it fun, whatever. I mean,
and of course, Truman Capote's from the same little town in Alabama.
He's still in the book.
That Harper Lee is
right.
Still lives in today.
Yes, yes. So, you know, it makes for fun, and that's fine, just like J.K. Rowling didn't write, you know, Harry Potter, blah, blah, whatever. Let me tell you a little bit why this book has been banned in the past, which is kind of fun. It has been banned for showing conflict between adult and children. It refers to sex, God forbid. It has ungrammatical speech. It talks about the supernatural, witchcraft. It gives an unfavorable presentation of African Americans. It gives an unfavorable representation of whites. It's number 40 on the ALA's, that's American Library Association, most frequently challenged books. And there's over 30 million copies sold, translated into 40 languages. Mm. And at first, when the book came out, no one really noticed. The Atlantic Monthly in 1960 said, good hammock reading for the summer.
Wow.
Yeah, so it wasn't until the later 1960s when conservatives and liberals in the South began to object to it. And then in the 1970s, it became an embarrassment to the South to have this book, so there were more objections. Then we have a second wave of banning, which happens in the Midwest and the Northeast because of profanity and how African Americans are portrayed as being helpless. You know, Atticus is supposedly this guy who's going to help them and free them. So that got a lot of criticism. And then in the 1980s, things subsided a little bit, but it's still happening today. It still gets banned. It's crazy. But if you look at it as a love of reading, maybe everyone can just calm down a wee bit. I don't know. Hopefully.
And if you haven't read it, of course, Stacy wants you to pick up To Kill a Mockingbird and read it this week.
Yes, please.
Along with the new one, if you're reading that. Here's a comment on our Facebook page from John. Mockingbird is my favorite because it portrays Scout as being more rational and wiser than the adults around her, and it portrays a recluse as a good person.
Absolutely.
And here's a tweet from a listener. Here's a little known fact. Truman Capote was raised as a kid during the summers right here in Springfield.
Oh, wow. That's so cool.
Didn't know that either. Let's go to Jerry on the South Side. Go ahead, Jerry.
Hi, Jerry.
Yeah, hi. You know, I had the same opinion as your earlier caller about the Truman Capote Harper Lee connection.
Yeah, don't go down that road. It's not true.
Well, yeah, I wanted to say, I did the comparison. I kind of sat down. I bought a couple of the copies of the early Capote books and did a plagiarism search. And tried to compare the two books. And after I did that, I came to the conclusion that Truman Capote played no part in writing To Kill a Mockingbird that is completely Harper Lee. So, I wanted to say that while a lot of people have held this theory for a long time, I think that's debunked in my own mind anyway.
Good. Thank you for the call, Jerry.
You know what else is fun about this book are the people's names in the book. And I love to do this when I read stories, is to look at why characters are named what they are and try to figure it out. The name of the editor for the town's newspaper is Mr. Underwood, like the typewriter.
Uh-huh. Well, apropos of nothing, in the show House of Cards, which I love, Frank Underwood, Kevin Spacey's character, he types on an Underwood typewriter, an old-fashioned one. But speaking of names, it's been interesting to see that people who name their children Atticus are now upset because with Go Set a Watchman being published, Atticus is portrayed in his old age as a bigot and becoming increasingly resistant to civil rights progress. But these are names that are embedded in our culture now.
Right.
Atticus Finch, right. Scout, Boo Radley, and Jem, and Calpurnia. And so those names are powerful.
Yeah. Well, you know, this just goes to show you only name pets after characters from novels. That's how we solve that problem. Don't name, okay? Name your children after your grandparents or something. But I know a lot of people name also Binx Bowling from the moviegoer, Walker Percy's wonderful book. There's a lot of Binx Labradors running around and young people running around. So I think it's wonderful, you know? I don't know. There are some other very fun names in the book. This poor new teacher just gets... Oh, she just gets reamed on her first day of school because she just doesn't understand the culture of Macomb. And her name is Miss Caroline Fisher. Like, she's fishing for answers. See, this excites me. I don't know. Maybe that's kind of odd. Well, and Scout, who's looking, who's searching.
She's searching. And this is a book that everyone should read. And and they need to continue the conversation with you.
Yes,
so
please,
you want everyone's emails.
Yes, yes. Please send your emails to bookclub@wjct.org. If you want a kind of a helper, when you go back to read Mockingbird, because I'm from the North, I did not know what Lane Cake was or what Sam Hill meant. on my website, I have a To Kill a Mockingbird addendum. It's a
little bit of a translator.
Yeah, that you can download, and that's at chapterendnotes.com. I also suggest you go back and read Rima Thompson's article on jacksonville.com that came out on Saturday the 18th. This is banned issues happening in our city today. 2015, people don't want people to learn. So go check out Rima's wonderfully written piece. And if you want to get involved in BAND, a conversation about free speech and censorship in Jacksonville, but will go national, I'm convinced, go to bandjax1@gmail.com and tell them you want to get involved. By the way, Tom Robinson's trial, based on a real trial. It was based on a trial in the 1930s. This is very important. Forget Truman Capote. This is real. It was called the Scottsboro Nine case in the 1930s. Nine African-American men accused of raping two white women. They were all tried and convicted. There was no evidence. Zilch, none. So they went through the appeals process over and over and over, and none of them were sentenced to death. But their lives were filled with this horrible cross that they had to bear.
Always learn when I speak to you, and thanks for joining us.
Oh, je vous en prie. It's been my pleasure. Do you want to know about next month?
Yeah, what's next month's book?
Quick. It's about Blinks. Blinks are books and films. I made up that word. So read either Gone with the Wind, A Prayer for Owen Meany, which the movie is Simon Birch. Go check out and then read the book. And then we're going to talk about our experiences. Because, you know, that's kind of a weird thing. So we're going to all talk Blinks.
I love it. And that's next month.
Blinks. Sorry.
Blinks.
Yeah, next month. Yeah,
and we're
Blinks.
Back in a moment.
New name, new look. Join us for our annual Women's Health Conference, Girls Day Out, August 15th, Hyatt Regency Hotel. Afternoon keynote speaker Dinah Jordan's motivational messages ring loud and true about how we can make the choice to be happy, finding the funny in your life, taking responsibility for your own health, ways to bust stress, and in doing these four things can make a happier, healthier, more productive you. Good for You Girls Day Out is hosted by Baptist Health and WJCT. For a complete list of speakers or to purchase your tickets, log on to wjct.org/goodforyou.
Even in tough economic times, there are many local stories of success. I'm Karen Mathis with the Daily Record. On First Coast Success, I speak with Northeast Florida business executives and entrepreneurs about their experiences and accomplishments. Hear the interviews the last Monday of each month on First Coast Connect or on demand at wjctnews.org.
Brought to you in part by Iberia Bank.
Discover the latest and greatest in independent music tonight at 11 on The Indie Endeavor.
Welcome back, and finally this hour, it is wonderful news for Jacksonville's Edward Waters College. EWC awarded two 2015 HBCU, that's Historically Black College or University Awards, presented by the HBCU Digest at their annual ceremony held up at Hampton University Friday. Now, one of the awards goes to a faculty member studying the high rates of asthma among African Americans in Jacksonville. Dr. Brian Seymour's pilot study results could lead to improved health care and eventually help to reduce the high mortality rate among African Americans in our area with allergic disorders. Dr. Seymour, research director for the EWC Center for the Prevention of Health Disparities, joins us now. Good morning.
Good morning.
And congratulations on your award.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah, that's wonderful news. And they honored you because this study has potentially huge ramifications. Tell us about the research.
Yes, we had collected some serum samples, some blood from about 200 participants from Health Zone 1. And we looked for a protein in the blood. It's an antibody. And this antibody is in everyone's blood, But if you're allergic, or if you have allergic asthma, or if you have parasitic infection, it is elevated. So what we found was that out of the 200 participants, we had 65% of them had significantly elevated levels of this antibody or this protein.
65%?
65%, right. And this is just as I said, this is an indicator of allergy, asthma, or as like in the third world, it would be an indicator of parasitic infection, because that's the purpose of that antibody, is to fight off parasitic infection. However, where asthma and allergy comes in, it is basically a mistake in our immune system that pushes us to develop large amount of these antibodies. And those are the ones that we would deem asthmatic or allergic.
Asthma rates in Jacksonville, particularly among African Americans, much higher than average. It's a serious public health issue for this city. How do you hope your study results can begin to try to help bring down those high rates?
Okay, first of all, I have to continue the study. We have to get some more detailed information. For example, the study that I just did, it tells us that 65% of the population of the study participant, which is an indicator of the people in health zone 1, has these elevated levels of these antibodies. However, it doesn't tell us specifically what is it that we are inhaling in our community that actually is giving us this high levels of antibody. So the phase 2 of the study is to actually see specifically what is it that we are inhaling in our community, and from that we can take it. I already have a team. I have a team of researchers and public health officials, and we're ready to actually get back into the community and to continue this study.
And hopefully this award will help attract that funding.
Yes.
How would the second phase of the research play out? How will you go about this?
Okay, so I have workers from, you know, of officials from the Mayo Clinic that is interested in continuing this study. I have an allergist. And so what we want to do is to actually get into the nitty-gritty of this study. For example, he's going to look at lung function, because one of the characteristics of asthma, besides this elevated levels of this antibody, is wheezing or narrowing of the airway, which we call bronchial hyperresponsiveness. And he has the capacity and the capability to do these studies. Basically, we also have I'm as the director of the newly built Center for Health Disparities, you know, we're interested in expanding the building so that we can have a research lab in there, and we can have a doctor's clinic, mm-hmm. so that we can do these studies.
And tell us a little bit more about your center that you're heading up, the prevention of health disparities.
Yes. So in this building, what we're hoping to do is we're looking for infrastructure money right now. And what we're hoping to do is actually set up a lab so that I can do my testing right there. We want to have a state-of-the-art lab, because many of the testing that I would love to do, we cannot really do it at this point. But we're looking for, you know, a better facilities to equip our lab. We are also looking for a room where the doctor that we're gonna have could meet with patients and so on, and do further testing. We're looking for counseling, you know, because health zone 1, you know, it's the poorest health zone of the 6 health zone. We have high rate of not just asthma, but we also have high rate of STDs, HIV, you know, diabetes and so on.
Right.
So eventually we would like to expand our horizon to take care of all of this, because ultimately we're trying to bring the disparities, this health disparity in our community down to health equity.
Right. And Health Zone 1, as you say, the health disparities are alarming. We're talking the urban core, parts of the north and northwest sides of Jacksonville, asthma being just one of those conditions. And so the work you're doing is so important.
Yes, it is. It is. You know, we are interested in looking at the entire spectrum of the people in the health zone, because, I mean, what is the reason for these high levels of, at least in my part that I'm working on, what's the reason for these high levels of allergy and asthma in our community? We have people living on contaminated land. You know, health zone 1 is known to have the highest rate of lead in lead in the community, in the housing, you know, health zone one, probably we're going to look at fungal exposure in the community. And a lot of these things may have something to do with the high levels of asthma and the high emergency room visit from people in our community with respect to asthma and allergy.
I so look forward to your continued work, and kudos on the recognition. Please keep us posted.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Sure.
He's Dr. Brian Seymour, Research Director at Edward Waters College's Center for the Prevention of Health Disparities, EWC, awarded two HBCU awards, one of them going to Dr. Seymour. And his important work, we'll continue to follow that on this program. And that's our show. Thanks to all of our guests and callers. Our producer is Sean Birch. The show theme composed and performed by the Jacksonville Symphony Orchestra's Pyotr Chevchik. Never miss a program. Our daily podcasts are now up on iTunes and Stitcher. Next on Diane Rehm, President Obama begins a campaign to sell the Iran nuclear deal at home and abroad. A look at efforts to address objections from Congress and concerns of key allies over the deal from Israel and Saudi Arabia. That's next. I'm Melissa Ross, and you're listening to First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT-FM Jacksonville, your community, your world. We'll be right back here again at 9 a.m. tomorrow. Have a great day.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.